justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of Africa Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Morning and welcome to Community Watch and Comment for Tuesday, May 27th. I am Jaina Parker and I am solo today, but my co-host Dave Rabin will be back to join us soon. Listeners, please call us right now at 202-588-0893. That is 202-588-0893, because today we are joined first by Brittany Drakeford of the Capital Market, and then later on in the show, we will be joined by Andrea Barron of TASSC, Torture Abolition and Survivor Support Coalition. So please give us a call so you can get your questions in at 202-588-0893. And we're going to jump right in. Good morning, Ms. Drakeford. Thank you for joining us today. And let's start by talking about you and your organization. But first, tell us about you, yourself, your history, and how your organization began.
Good morning, Jaina. Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here with you today to talk about our work with the Capital Market. So the Capital Market is a community-led organization that centers food systems and leverages cultural capital to revitalize communities through advocacy, education, small business support, and land use development. I'm a sixth-generation Prince George's County resident. My family was actually, I have ancestors who were actually enslaved in Prince George's County. And our organization formed in 2018 in direct response to the ongoing cycle of disinvestment and food apartheid happening in Capitol Heights, Maryland. There was a very popular grocery store that left, and we said, hey, we don't want to just live in a community without a grocery store, without access to fresh fruits and vegetables. So we organized community members to start a farmer's market right along the Blue Line corridor on Central Avenue. And so our mission is deeply rooted and not just increasing food access for residents in neighborhoods that have been victims of systemic marginalization, but also to advocate for increased land ownership for Black farmers, financial support for Black businesses, and organizing residents through foodways and free food stories that we cherish today.
That's amazing. That's wonderful. I love the fact that you're a sixth generation Prince George's resident and those deep connections. But why don't you tell us a little bit more about your history and who you are and how you came to be with the Capital Food Market a little bit more?
Yeah. No, so awesome question. So I grew up in Prince George's County. I attended Prince George's County Public Schools. I graduated from Charles Herbert Flowers. This is actually going to be my 20th class reunion this year. And so as a kid, right, I would constantly drive around the Capitol Heights, Seat Pleasant community. As I mentioned, this is where my family is from. My mother grew up here. She was born here. Her mother, they all grew up in this area. And so as a kid, I would constantly ride in the car with my mother and my grandmother, and they would point out where our family land used to be. Our great-great-great-grandfather, my great-great-great-grandfather, owned about 9 acres of land along present-day Sheriff Road, which used to be, or MLK Avenue, which used to be like George Palmer Highway. And he owned about 9 acres.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, right.
I'm sorry. I was just taking it like, wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, so he owned about 9 acres of land over there. And he was a farmer, right? And so he farmed. He purchased the land from Mary Sheriff, But he was a farmer, and that's, you know, what he did to help to sustain his family. Over time in Sea Pleasant, there was an urban renewal that happened in Sea Pleasant around the 60s and 70s. So unfortunately, the family lost that family land. But as a child, I constantly remember those stories of my mother and grandmother pointing out that family land and its importance to our family and the connections that we had in the community. So from there, I ended up going away to school and I studied journalism, African-American history. And I was really deeply invested in the stories of Black people and Black communities and the ways in which food is an integral part of that. I enjoy cooking. I'm a beekeeper, so I love, and I'm also a grower, so I grow fruits and vegetables. And I've always just been so amazed by the power that food has and the power that our food stories have. So when the grocery store left our community, creating a farmer's market or creating an organization to respond to that seemed directly appropriate. I had done a lot of organizing work, working in North Carolina for an arts-based organization. I also done some organizing work in Prince George's County and in D.C. And so I was really able to take some of those skills that I had learned from other places and then bring them back home directly in my community.
That's wonderful. I want to dig in a little bit. I mean, you talk so much about your connection to this area and the cultural connection, as well as just the historical connection to this area. And then you went to school initially for the Mass Communications and African-American Studies. Can you talk about how you picked African-American Studies in context to your like historical connection to Prince George's County, and then how that kind of all centered around the food?
Yeah. So growing up in Prince George's County, I was always a kid who was very like observant. So I would listen to the stories, like I said, of my mother, my grandfather, my grandmother, my father, my uncles, right? And I would just sit around and soak all those things in. Another person who I would soak stuff up from afar was Miss Mildred Ridgely Gray. Mrs. Mildred Ridgely Gray was a, she's basically, you know, she's an ancestor now, but she was an activist in her own right. She lived along Central Avenue. Her family owned land. We believe they were descendants of the Concord Plantation. And Mrs. Gray worked to fight to organize and protect Black landmarks in Prince George's County. So one of the church where actually my family attended many years ago, and also the church where my ancestors are buried, is the Ridgely Church off of Central Avenue. And so back in the 80s and 90s, State Highway Administration wanted to demolish that property and demolish the church to widen the road. And so Mrs. Mildred Ridgely Gray got together with some people and she organized to fight back against it. And so looking at all of these different spaces as a kid growing up, I was bused from the Mitchellville area, Glenard area, all the way up to Beltsville for school, right? So every day I was traveling and I was looking at the community around me. And so I said to myself, like, I wanted to make a change in my community. And so that's how I ended up studying journalism and African-American studies, right? Looking at the stories of Mrs. Gray and how she organized. And so the question that I always had for myself was, what are the things that I can do to advance and to protect and to save Black communities? And so on one hand, I thought like, okay, well, promoting the stories and doing storytelling would be one aspect of it. And then the other story that I thought was, well, I needed to be able to actually understand the history and then be able to tell those stories. So that's how I studied journalism and African-American studies. Then I decided to go to grad school and study business because I was working for a nonprofit and I saw some of the challenges, particularly like financial challenges that nonprofits had and organizational and operational challenges. So I said, okay, well, maybe if I then study business, I can start to speak the language that can also make these organizations sustainable. And so so then I started connecting with friends. We started to grow food. I graduated from college in 2009 in undergrad, which was probably like one of the worst times to come out during the middle of an economic recession. And I started to get back to the land. I started to play in the dirt. I started to grow food. And that was, I think, for me, really the catalyst that kicked a lot of this off. I also say that I do this work alongside of my cousin, Kyle Reeder, and my sister, Ashley Drake Ford, as well as many other community members who are deeply vested in growing like the future that we want to see in Prince George's County and in Capitol Heights.
That's amazing. That's really awesome work. Thank you so much for expanding on that. And so as you talked about your organization's like mission and vision, kind of just tell the community a little bit more about your work in context to what you provide and where you're located and how often it's done. And again, callers, you can call in at 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893.
Yeah. So at the Capitol Market, we really see food as the center and food systems as the center of all community, right? So we look at food not just as an aspect or partially as an aspect to get fresh fruits and vegetables to people, but also we see food and food systems development as an economic and community development strategy that equitably can equitably rebuild our neighborhoods, right? I'm a fundamental believer that the original, when we think about economic development or community development in the United States, it is fundamentally, or it is originally through the development of the agriculture system, right? And we all know that agriculture in the United States is rooted in slavery, right? Mm-hmm. And that is the, what we refer to as like the original sin, right, of slavery. Mm-hmm. And so that's where labor, right, where we look at even labor laws today are still deeply impacted by the plantation economy, how we understand what food is, our belief of how accessible or where food should come from, who should be working in what types of fields or what types of industries, as well as just how housing and all these other things connect. And so my belief is deeply that if we can build an equitable food system, that is how we actually build equitable communities. And without first thinking about food, the thing that is needed for everyone, that is the sustenance of all of life, right? And by thinking about how we can center food from an equitable perspective and develop food equitably and build an entire community around that, that's what is needed in order to launch and leverage equitable economic development in our communities to actually rebuild. And that's our theory at the Capitol Market. And so that's how we see our work. And that's how we organize. So what that looks like then for us is we do a variety of different programming. So we have things called our farmers markets, where we do pop-up farmers markets in communities. So we have two farmers markets that we're actually working on right now. One in partnership with a community called Creative Suitland, which is an art space community in Suitland, Maryland. And then the second, which is at Walker Mill, which will be at Walker Mill Park on June 21st. And that activity is actually one that is deeply important to us because that market is actually on the same grounds where our family was enslaved in Prince George's County. So for us, having a market at Walker Mill Park or Farmers Market is completely a full circle moment. Other programming that we do are things called healthy food walk audits, where we really work with residents and those who are most impacted by unequitable and inequitable food systems to get them out to learn about the language of planning, the language of zoning, and how they can then take certain information and then advocate to elected officials and public officials to see the transformation in the communities that we want. We also do a program called the Blue Line Corridor Civic Leadership Institute, which is another community-based training program, again, around healthy communities, healthy planning, and supporting advocacy in our neighborhoods. As an organization, we work primarily along the Blue Line Corridor in Prince George's County. So that is Central Avenue. So if you can think right from where 495 starts all the way to Southern Avenue, that is our target area that we focus a lot of our work in. But we also work in communities across Prince George's County as well.
That's awesome. And so, like, in talking about like all the work that you do and all the accessibility, let's move into the question around, this is spaced in Prince George's County. This is Prince George's County centered work. And so what are your thoughts and how do you see this work connecting to the impacted federal workers? Because, you know, Prince George's County has a large federal population in context to federal workers, and there could be a huge transition from them working for the federal government to working in different capacities or just not having employment at all. And so how do you see your work connecting to this?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I think that's a question that so many of us are thinking about, both from a nonprofit space in Prince George's County, so twofold, one from a services perspective, but then also from an operations perspective. So we know that, like you said, Prince George's County has some of the highest concentration of federal workers across the region. And particularly those workers are Black workers. And we also know that just because of systemic racism, because of issues around marginalization, residential segregation, all these things, right? And we saw this back during the foreclosure crisis around 2008, 2009 in Prince George's County, that when there are massive changes at the federal level, right, Black people typically are hit the hardest. And so we can also see that, you know, then possibly happening in Prince George's County. So some of the things that we're anticipating is, one, you know, trying to increase our services. So the capital market, as a farmer's market, we do work with local farmers and we are a fee-based organization. So what that means is when we host our farmer's market or our pop-up, our farmer's markets, we do sell produce or we work with farmers or other food-based businesses to sell products, right? So some of the things that we are anticipating, because we also do SNAP programs and SNAP matching, is that we'll probably see an increase of individuals who will be using food assistance as a way to provide for, to pay for fruits and vegetables or to purchase fruits and vegetables. We also do a program where we partner with local food pantries whenever we have excess produce that maybe we haven't sold at a farmer's market. It's called our Farmer Buyback Program, where we connect with local food pantries to distribute that. And what we've already seen with some of the food pantries that we've been working with is a drastic increase already of individuals who are coming to the food pantries to receive support. So we do anticipate that there may be a higher number of individuals, because we can talk about federal workers, but then there's also like tangential impacts of contract workers who may have been supporting the federal government. And that can be everyone from professional services down to people who might be doing other types of professional services like janitorial services, or they might be working in the cafeteria. So there are a wide range of impacts that we see. On the flip side, and I think this is actually for us, is there's an opportunity, right? So wherever there presents challenges, there also presents opportunities. So one of the other things that we have seen is through some of individuals who have been, there have been reductions in force, that means they have a little bit more time, right? And some people have chosen through their extra free time to then dig deeper and invest more into the local community. And so we have also then seen an increase in volunteership in our organization of people who are saying, hey, we really love this mission about growing equitable food systems in Prince George's County and rebuilding economic development. And how can we do this? And how can we also make it profitable or sustainable so that other people in our community can have jobs and can have work and may not necessarily and have work and support small businesses in our community as well. So while there have been, we see challenges, we also see opportunities as ways to help people think of careers or think of pathways that they may have never thought possible or may have been a little timid or afraid to dive into fully.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I love how you touched on the other parts of how the impact of federal workers affect the economy and they affect other parts of the economy. And it's a ripple effect. And it's a huge ripple effect, particularly in this area. And how do we have to support the people that live with us and are with us every day? My final question is, what are your next steps for your organization? And feel free to, you know, elaborate as much as you can on where do you see your organization going and how it will support the community moving forward and like your vision for that?
Yeah. So I'll say, like, so first, a few weeks ago, I think maybe 2 weeks ago, we just did a kickoff of what's called, for the past year, we have been working to organize, and I'll shout out Kyle Reeder, Brian Franklin, and Marcus Robertson with the List DC team. We have been working to organize the city of Sea Pleasant, the town of Fairmont Heights, and the town of Capitol Heights as a collective to think about advancing economic development and community development in those areas. Those are three jurisdictions, three municipalities in along Central Avenue in Prince George's County that have historically faced systemic disinvestment, and they have faced historic systemic disinvestment, right? And we have worked to organize them to think about, look, you all have some shared challenges, but they're also shared opportunities. And what can we do to really start to invest and build the community that we want to see, right? And so we did a launch of that two Saturdays ago, I think on May 10th, I can't remember right now. But that ended up, or May 17th, that ended up being an outstanding event. So that's something that we are continuously growing and investing in. Another initiative that will be that we are working on launching soon, again, in partnership with List DC, also in partnership with one of our amazing council members, Vice Chair Crystal Rieva and Delegate Jazz Lewis, is the launch of the Blue Line Corridor the Blue Line Corridor Coalition. That is a coalition that is bringing together stakeholders from across the corridor, again, to think about how do we advance economic development and looking at food and agriculture as one of the industries that could possibly be used. Again, when we're thinking about building small businesses, we often are planners and other people look outside the community for investment. And we're saying, well, what are some opportunities that already exist in our community through agriculture, through green manufacturing that we can use and leverage to build up residents who live right here in the Capitol Heights, Fairmont Heights, Sea Pleasant communities. So that's one thing that we have, which is really big for us. And we really see that as a very exciting programming. We're also looking in partnership with the Prince George's County Arts and Humanities Council, doing some arts-based activations around the community and doing some really exciting programs to get people outside, to take up space. And again, just to make this community and to make our community what we vision. Oftentimes we go to workshops and people talk about what we want to see. Right. And now we're like, hey, one of our values at the Capitol Market is self-determination. And so now we're like, look, we said what we want to see. And now let's put our foot to the pedal and make it happen. So those are some things just more broadly that we're excited for. I'm really excited for those programs, as well as our upcoming farmers market season, some of the pop-up markets that we'll be doing this year across Prince George's County.
That's amazing. And we do have a caller on the line. Caller, if you could tell us your name and where you're from and go ahead with your question.
This is Rick calling you long distance from Germany, ladies.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much, Rick.
Hi, Rick. Nice to meet you.
I just want to lay out three documentaries which might build our health and give us hope against climate change and apocalypse. First, there's a documentary called They're Trying to Kill Us. It's a documentary on meat and the supermarket foods that we eat. Second, there's a documentary called Kiss the Ground, and it's on farming and the ignorance of many farmers over the last 100 years and the Nazi connections to pesticides and agribusiness. The hope is that a few farmers, scientifically and with the help of government and business, will find better grazing and farming practices. The sequel to Kiss the Ground is the sequel Common Ground, on how farming could heal some of the atmosphere. And our ability to breathe on this planet. Ladies, I'm done.
Thank you so much for sharing. Did you have a question?
Oh, no, okay. I'm done, ladies.
No worries. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Jaina, if I could, I really just wanted to respond to some of those documentaries, and I really appreciate Rick calling that out. And I do want to highlight and just note that, you know, with the capital market, we work with multiple different primarily Black farmers and returning farmers who are based in Prince George's County. And all of the farmers that we work with do regenerative farming, right? They do regenerative farming and other farming practices that really look at reducing the impacts of climate change. So I just want to shout out farms like Three Part Harmony Farms, Spice Creek Enterprises, 804 Cattle Company, Sisters of the Soil, Black Dirt Farm Collective, and also Witt's Farm. But there are hosts of other farms that we work with. Also shout out to all our farmers at the Urban Farm Incubator, where we partner with, and they're doing exactly some of those practices that Rick talked about, as a way to think about how do we not just bring healthy foods to people, but also make sure that we're protecting the environment while we do that. And that's also something that's really big for us at the capital market, is thinking about the balance between equity, economic development, and the environment.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much. And I just want to thank our guest, Ms. Brittany Drakeford from the Capital Market, for joining us today. Please go ahead and search her out and see what she is doing and the amazing work that they continue to do in the community. Again, thank you so much for joining us, Ms. Brittany Drakeford.
Thank you, Jaina, so much. It was a pleasure, and the pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much for your platform and for the work that you're doing as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Now we will be moving to, all right, listeners, please call us at 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. As we welcome our next guest, Andrea Barron of the Torture Abolitionist and Survivor Support Coalition. Hey, Ms. Barron, thank you for joining us today. We are so excited to hear from you and see you virtually today. Let me see. Okay.
Okay, am I okay now?
Yep, we can hear you now.
Okay, great.
So yeah, thank you for joining us today. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Give us a little bit of history about yourself first, and then move into your organization and how you guys connected.
Okay, so my name is Andrea Barron, and I'm the Advocacy Program Manager at TASC, the Torture Abolition and Survivor Support Coalition. So my background is international politics and also human rights. So TASC was a perfect place for someone like me, because I get to interact directly with the torture survivors that we work with. I get to know them. I get to hear their stories. It's very personal. And at the same time, I get to work on policy issues, on broader policy issues in the U.S. Congress and with the State Department. So it's a perfect combination for someone like me to work on policy and actually deal every single day with the people whose lives we're trying to improve.
Oh, that's amazing. That's really wonderful. And so how did you get connected to this work?
So, I got connected. I used to work for another organization that placed students in internships, and I placed some of the students at this particular organization, at TASC. But I always wanted to work directly on advocacy. And so when an opportunity arose for this organization, I took it. That was way back in the end of 2013. So I've been at TASC for a long time.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So there are a lot of things that your organization does, and it's really a great thing that you guys have been doing in context to supporting the survivors around torture and abolitionists and things of that nature. So can you tell us about the various programs under the programming that you run specifically?
Sure. So I'll focus on, again, let me just give you very quick background. We were founded in 1998 by Sister Diana Ortiz, who was an American nun who was raped and tortured in 1989 in Guatemala. So advocacy was very, very important to her. And that's why we are the only torture treatment program. There's over 30 torture treatment programs in the United States, but we are the only one that also, in addition to providing direct services for torture survivors and legal assistance, we have an advocacy program because that's part of our legacy. And of course, we're only 20 minutes from the U.S. Congress. So my job as advocacy program director is I work with the survivors who are about maybe more than 90% are from Africa, Ethiopia, Cameroon, Eritrea, Sudan. We also have a few from other countries, but mostly from Africa. So what I do is I work with them to hear their stories about why they were persecuted, mostly for political reasons. We also have a small LGBT community, but mostly they were persecuted for political reasons, for standing up to dictatorships in their country. And I prepare them so that when we go to Congress, they can speak directly. So I'm kind of like a trainer and a facilitator, organizing these congressional meetings. And it's very unusual. And, you know, members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, are always really excited to hear directly from the survivors instead of other people telling their stories. They tell their own stories. And then, of course, what we try to do is we try to see if we can find a way to influence U.S. policy on their countries and also the asylum process, which is very, very important to them. So my job is kind of a trainer, I consider myself, working directly with them, and it's really very, very satisfying. And the other program that we do, which is a new program and very small at this point, which we just started, is I was given a grant from an organization called the International Rehabilitation Council for Torture Victims based in Copenhagen. So we got a small grant to train torture survivors in other countries in the global south in how to become advocates, because that's, you know, I would call it my area of expertise is mostly working with them to train them. So I recently went to Uganda, and I met, we're talking December of 2024 and a few days in January of 2025, and I met refugees from Rwanda, Eritrea, and Sudan living in Uganda and train them how to become advocates. So I'll just give you one good example is we have a lot of Rwanda refugees. Now, many people, when they think about Rwanda, they remember the genocide of 1994 when over 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed, massacred in this horrendous genocide. And then Paul Kagame, who was the head of the army that came from Uganda, he was able to stop the genocide. However, unfortunately, like what happens in much part of the world, he ended up becoming a dictator. So many people don't know that when they think about Rwanda. They think about it's very orderly, it's very beautiful. It's also a dictatorship. And if you criticize the government, you can get in a lot of trouble. So the people I met had fled Rwanda either because they themselves were persecuted or their relatives were forcibly disappeared. And so they fled to Rwanda and they're living, not only are they poor, but they're very vulnerable because they're very worried that they could get targeted by Rwandan agents in Uganda and get abducted and brought back forcibly to Rwanda. So my project, the project we're working on, is with the children of these refugees and to raise money for the children to go to school. Because even though in a country like Uganda and also other African countries, officially primary and secondary education is free, but the end result ends up that people have to pay school fees. We're not talking only about for books and uniforms, but actually fees to attend school. So the parents engaged in this major advocacy effort, and they wrote a petition. They wrote it in their language, Kinyarwanda. And then we translated it into English, which is pretty easy because Kinyarwanda, the language of Rwanda, is written in Latin letters. And they wrote a petition explaining why it's so important for them, for their children to go to school. And if they don't get some funds, their kids cannot go to school. So they did a great job. And as a result, we organized a fundraiser for them. And now we have money to send the kids to school. We can't do it indefinitely because it's only for one trimester. Maybe we'll have money for a second trimester, but it still made a huge difference. And then just very briefly, we have two other small projects in Africa. One is for Eritrean, a group of five Eritrean footballers. So in Eritrea, these are female. They're playing soccer, but they call them footballers. And these five girls defected in Uganda. They were supposed to play in a football or soccer competition in 2021, and they defected. And now they're living in one room, five of them, one room. They can never go out because they're afraid to go out. And we're trying to help them get resettled in the third country. That could take years. And as many people know, the U.S. no longer accepts refugees, you know, except white South Africanas. Other than that, they don't accept any refugees because these girls would be a perfect fit. Perfect. So what we're doing is we raise money to at least give them a better life, maybe buy them a computer, get them blankets, get them pillows, more food while they're waiting for resettlement. And the third project is for Sudanese refugees. And all of these people are torture survivors because our job is to work with torture survivors to end torture and empower the survivors and their families. So they're all survivors and they're refugees at the same time. So because of the civil war that started in Sudan way back in April 2023, there are many, many, many Sudanese who have fled from Sudan to seek sanctuary. And about 70,000 of them are in Uganda. So we're working with the ones in Uganda, and we have two projects. One is for This is a very, very sad result of the huge U.S. cut in foreign aid, which has affected. Here's a direct example. This cut in U.S. foreign aid. Now there are women in the refugee camp do not have access to sanitary pads. We're calling them feminine hygiene products, but so everybody is very clear, we're talking about sanitary pads. And that was one of the major things they asked for. So we are now raising money. We've done really well to send them sanitary pads. And again, I wish we had thousands of dollars to send thousands of sanitary pads, but we're making a difference in their lives. And then we also have another small project helping women rape victims from Darfur in Sudan. And two of them are going to start a small cooking project. And then we also have an artist project. These are famous Sudanese artists who are living in a refugee camp, and we're helping them buy watercolors and oil paints because that will give meaning to their lives and help them survive. So that's kind of what I've been working on. Again, there's a lot of other things our organization is doing, especially the legal program, but I focus, because you asked me, on what we're doing, my projects.
No, that is amazing. That is really detailed. That is really important in regards to the advocacy that you have been doing in the programming. Can you talk a little bit more about the artists in Darfur and the watercolors and how that is supporting? Because I don't think we touch enough on how art impacts, life.
Yeah, so what happened is the exciting thing about these three projects is I met all of these people. So when I left the country, that was not part of my grant, was to be able to start these small projects. But I came back and I had incredible contacts. And one of the contacts with the Sudanese was my boss, whose name is Ayman Taber, who is himself a torture survivor from Sudan. So the executive director of our organization has always been a torture survivor himself, or herself. And so Ayman connected me with the Sudanese there. And again, I had someone from a group called Surbana that connected me with the Eritreans, and I had someone from Rwanda that connected me with the Rwandans. So when I was there in December, I met one of these famous artists. I can mention his name. His name is Ali Alamin. Some of the Rwandan names and the Eritreans, they're kept secret because they're being targeted by their governments. But I can mention the artists. And he told me about all of these artists I mean, again, this is a radio program. If it was visual, I could send you some of these magnificent paintings that the artist did, you know, because they were professional artists, beautiful, beautiful paintings. And what he said is they're living in this refugee camp, you know, where they hardly have any food now and they can't get free water anymore, also because of cuts from Donald Trump. So in order to get water, they have to walk and buy water. But they didn't ask me. They didn't ask for money for water. They wanted to know how we could get them some art supplies so that they could create art. And then they want to have some sort of a project where they're going to be able to talk about the meaning of art and talk about the suffering in Sudan, the Sudanese civil war. We're not funding that part of the project, so we don't have as many details. But part one, of course, is getting them the art supplies. And then they're going to do some of the painting. And of course, they're going to send us photos of the paintings. We're going to get photos and, you know, details after all these projects, because we want people to know exactly where their money is going. So we were promised, I don't know how long it's going to take them to do the paintings, but we will get photos of the paintings. And, you know, that's very, very important for them. And I guess I'm sort of an amateur artist. I'm not very good, but I try. And I know that expressing creativity, like for me, when I get sick, I don't really get sick of politics. I get kind of exhausted and a little bit upset about dealing with political situation. I draw and I paint, and it, you know, it calms me and it gives me an outlet and relieves stress in my life. So I can just imagine for these professional artists how that is so important for them. But it's not only for them personally, it's also how they are going to be able to express to the rest of the world what's happening to the Sudanese people. So
I think that's so very, very important to make sure that we get out the word of what is happening in other countries to the people in other countries. You mentioned earlier that every one of the CEOs or the people that are over the organization has been a torture survivor themselves. Can you talk about how important that is to the work? This just that connection between.
So what, again, the very first director was Sister Diana Ortiz, the one who she herself was a torture survivor, and she founded the organization. And it wasn't, I don't think it's kind of legal, but we just decided the very first survivor that we had was Sister Diana. The second executive director was from Ethiopia. The third one was from Ethiopia. The fourth one was from Rwanda, and Eamon is from Sudan. So I've kind of met all of them because I've been there such a long time. And our organization is different because we want the survivors, we say in some ways it's survivor-led, we want the survivors themselves to play a role in forming the organization and in deciding what kind of work the organization is going to do. So it's different from, of course, we have professionals, you know, especially the lawyers and the other professionals working in the organization. But we wanted the director to be a survivor because it kind of is a symbol to show that we are incorporating survivors in our work. And I'll give you a perfect example. We also, I have to say that the survivors that we have are very, very highly educated people because they were mostly political dissidents in their country. So I consult with them. So when I'm good, people say, well, how do you decide what are the issues you're going to work on? And here's a perfect example. So we have our annual June Survivors Week coming up at the end of June, because it's June Survivors Week, that we hold every year on or around June 26th. Which is the day designated by the United Nations as International Day in Support of Victims of Torture. So we have a whole series of activities around that last week of June. And we also have two advocacy days in Congress. So we will be setting up maybe, you know, 30, 35 congressional meetings. We hope to have about 40 people, and over half will be the survivors themselves. So I always ask, well, how do you decide what you're going to talk about? So I will speak to our Ethiopians and I'll say, what are your big issues now? And so we have people from the ethnic Amhara group in Ethiopia that want to focus on what's happening to Amhara. And we have people from Ethiopia from the Tigray ethnic group, and they have different priorities. So we'll have one delegation focusing on Amhara issues, another one focused on Tigray, because that's what they want to do. So I listen to them. I have Zoom meetings with them on a regular basis. And then we kind of come up with some, it's kind of a discussion. It's not me dictating to them or them dictating to me. We talk with each other and then we figure out what's the best way to approach what we want to ask for in Congress. And then this year, for the first time, we're going to have an LGBT delegation simply because there's an assault on the LGBT population in the United States, of course, but also in other countries. And that's been going on for a long time, extremely homophobic countries. And we have somebody from Zimbabwe, someone from the Democratic Republic of Congo, maybe two people, somebody from Nicaragua, and I might get someone who is an LGBT community member who is from Jamaica, who's living in New York. Because sometimes we get people that come from out of town, like New York and New Jersey, to come all the way here in Delaware to do our advocacy, participate in our advocacy. We've also had an Eritrean leader who lives in Delaware, and he comes every year all the way from Delaware to participate in our advocacy. And so this year we're going to focus on persecution, what's happening to the LGBT population in these countries, how dangerous it is for them. So, you know, we are continuing, our survivors are what are called affirmative asylum seekers. So they enter the country, most of them, legally with visas. They're not undocumented. But we're still worried that, you know, with this anti-immigrant kind of wave that we have in this country, we're still worried that some of them might get denied asylum. So it's really important to be able to impress in Congress on Republican and Democratic offices how much this LGBT population is suffering in these countries. And we hope that that will have some influence. It's not direct influence, because it's not like, you know, somebody from Congress calls up an asylum officer in the U.S. citizenship, the USCIS, and tells them, oh, you have to grant asylum to these LGBT asylum seekers. But in general, we want to call attention to that problem for the first time this year, because we're very, very worried about them. And we're worried about all our survivors. We'll also be having a delegation this year on Cameroon, because there's an election coming up in Cameroon, and our Cameroonian survivors are very worried this will be a fraudulent election. And we want to talk about how important it is for there to be free and fair elections in Cameroon. We're doing that because that's what they want to talk about. You know, so I meet with the Cameroonians and I said, what's on your mind? What would you like to talk about this year? And then we also have a delegation about Sudan. And we have one of the people in our Sudan delegation is a torture survivor who was a prisoner of conscience from Amnesty International many years ago in the 90s. And he's very active in human rights issues around Sudan. We have another Sudanese survivor who is an amazing woman. She used to be a very famous singer in Sudan. She's visually impaired and she's got huge energy and she's just an incredible person. I'm very, very inspired myself by our survivors. And whenever I think to myself about whatever little problem I have, you know, I'm thinking, oh my God, these people were tortured and they do not sit around and feel sorry for themselves. They just never do that. They just share their story. They look forward to what's going to happen in the future, and they want to continue to speak out against torture in their country, because that is why they got involved, because they care. Of course, they care about themselves and their family, but they care about other people, too, in their country. Mm-hmm. And they want to focus on rebuilding their life here in the United States. So, you know, it's a very, you know, it's like a lot of times my friends all have jobs helping vulnerable people, whoever they are. But my vulnerable people are also inspirational to me because of how brave and courageous they are. And, you know, I get tears in my eyes sometimes. You can't see me because I'm not on video. But when I even talk about them and who they are, it's just amazing.
No, thank you so much for that. And we actually have a caller. Caller, please tell us where you're from and your name, where you're from, and go ahead and ask your question. Caller, can you hear us?
Can hear them.
Okay, caller, tell us your name and where you're from and go ahead and ask your question.
Yeah, my name is Michael, and actually, my first, I just want to commend the person for the work that you're doing in exposing victims of torture all over the globe and the diaspora. But my call was really to the person you had before from Prince George's County about the entrepreneurism and farmers market.
Yes, yeah, so she transitioned off the call. So we can just get your question around that later and just focus that to her. But thank you so much for calling in context to that.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. I want to circle back, Ms. Barron, and just kind of ask you about the event on May 29th as well. I know you talked about June 26th, but can you talk a little bit about May 29th?
Sure. So what was so exciting is when I came back from visiting, Uganda and visiting these refugees, and I started talking about these four projects, like the one specifically on providing feminine hygiene products, sanitary pads to the Sudanese refugee women. Lo and behold, one of our staff members says, oh, I'll organize a fundraiser at my house for this project. And I said, oh my God, I mean, this has never happened before in the 13 years. So she decided on May 29th that she's going to have a fundraiser for her friends at her house, just to raise money for these Sudanese women. And it's kind of a, it's a game where you kind of compete in different kind of cocktails that you make. And I don't drink, so I don't know how well I'm going to do in the competition, at all, but, it's a way, I guess, that young people can, young people, people in their 20s, people in their 30s, people in their 40s, how they can have a fun time by mixing cocktails and also contributing to a really, really good cause. So I'm looking forward to that on May 29th. And then I was able to call the woman who is coordinating this project in Uganda. So I speak to them all the time on WhatsApp. And first I said to her, well, I think we're going to raise $300 for sanitary napkins, which ends up being $1 for each napkin. And now we've already got $600. And this is even before the fundraiser. So I called her up again and she kind of can't believe it. It just happened spontaneously. And for me, it's very exciting because our whole agency, we have very collaborative, our organization, very collaborative. People work very closely together, the lawyers, the advocacy program. We have an employment counselor. We have somebody who works on social services. And we all work very, very closely together. And that's what's going to happen. So I'm really excited. And I'm also going to wear my dress. This is a little bit different subject, made in Chad. So I was in Chad last year as part of this project. And I was there on March 8th with International Women's Day. And so there I am sitting there talking about torture survivors in Chad. And all the women there are wearing these gorgeous dresses. They're either pink or green. And so they said, well, Andrea, we're going to make you one of these dresses. I said, okay. They said, what color? I said, I want the green one. So they took my measurements and 2.5 hours later, there was a dress. So I have this Chadian dress now, and I'm going to get to wear it to the fundraiser for the Sudanese women on Thursday. So I'm really excited about that.
That sounds awesome. That sounds awesome. I just wanted to take time to, we're about to close out now, but I just want to take time to thank you so much for joining us today. And that will do it for our show today. But thank you for joining us, Ms. Barron. And you're doing, talking about your amazing work. We really appreciate it. We really appreciate everything that you're doing. And thanks to amazing Mike for his engineering expertise. And we will see you next week for more Community okay. Watch and comment.
Bye-bye and thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. We'll be right back.
is Caribbean American Heritage Month. Thus, CAWI, CPN, ICS, AFI, and Africa World Now Project present the 23rd DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 6th to June 12th, at AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring. The festival showcases the best in Caribbean cinema with films such as the U.S. premiere of Fanon and more. The DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 6th to June 12th. Information at afi.com/silver or 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Thank you, family. We're so grateful for each and every one of you who made a pledge during our spring membership drive. Though we didn't quite reach the finish line, your love carried us far. Your pledges, your presence, your belief in WPFW. They remind us that this station is more than radio. It's a rhythm, a refuge, a revolution. We trust you'll keep walking with us, dancing with us, building with us. Because this community-powered radio station rises with you and only with you. Thank you for keeping the beat alive.
We rest in the city. We rest in the
Are you in the process of writing or updating your will, trust, or estate plan? We invite you to consider adding WPFW as a beneficiary through a charitable bequest. Bequests can take many forms and are usually the largest and most impactful gift a donor will ever make. Your bequest will help to ensure the programming WPFW has provided for almost 50 years will continue into the future. More info available by email at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or by phone at 202-588-0999, extension 344. Or you can let us know you've already included PFW in your plans through those same channels so we can add your name to our growing list of legacy listeners. We are listener supported. We are jazz and justice. And because of your support, we are WPFW.
On Saturday, May 31st and Sunday, June 1st, Capital Bop partners with Sycamore and Oak to present Jazz in the Heights, two full days of music in the Congress Heights neighborhood, featuring artists from D.C., Baltimore, and beyond. This two-day festival of jazz and culture will include appearances by Chelsea Green and the Green Project, Burkhead, the Desron Douglas Quartet, Deborah Bond, and more. Details at capitalbop.com or sycamoreandoak.com.
WPFW, in collaboration with the Josephine Butler Center, present the Jazz and Justice Festival, Sunday, June 22nd, noon until 8 p.m. An activation of music, poetry, social justice teach-ins, visual art, wellness, children's activities, and more in Malcolm X Park. WPFW personalities Saiz Kamaluddin, Kaaba Soul Singer, and Proverbs Reggae Band will be among the performers, with sets by DJ Lance Reynolds and Underdog. Also featured will be an art show curated by Adrian Ferguson of The Art of Noise and a community curated by Milani Douglas. Stay tuned to WPFW for updates and details.
Hashtag You Must Learn is your Thursday at 6 p.m. Liberatory Educational Radio Show, and we mourn the April 25th passing of the educational giant, Dr. Jawanza Kanjufu. So the Hashtag You Must Learn Collective is hosting a four-hour special program honoring Dr. Kanjufu on Thursday, May 29th from 3 to 7 p.m. We're going to have legendary elders who work directly with him, as well as juggernaut educators who were inspired by Dr. Kanjufu to reflect on his life. That's right, a four-hour special program honoring Dr. Jawanza Kanjufu on Thursday, May 29th from 3 to 7 p.m. Tune into this special program as WPFW builds a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Come, Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at WPFW.